Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are returning to a topic that we've covered quite a few times in the podcast, but it keeps on coming up and I think it's increasingly important. And that's the question of assisted suicide, also known as assisted dying, sometimes euthanasia. Terminology is complex. Before we go any further, obviously, it's going to be another episode dealing with a very sensitive topic about care of the dying and some really painful ethical dilemmas that come up in this area. So we just want to flag up that we're very aware that we don't want to be flippant or careless or callous about this, because lots of people will impinge on them and their loved ones very directly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I go around and give talks about this topic quite frequently, and one of the things I've is reinforced to me is that in any audience of a church, group of church members or so on, there will be people there who have watched horrendous things. You know, they've watched a loved one die, sometimes in very bad ways, in a very painful way, and therefore, those kind of deeply scarring personal experiences really change your viewpoint on a topic like this, because, you know, I can imagine a lot of people, including some Christian believers, saying, you know, wow, if that was me, I know, yeah, I'd want to take the tablets and make it all stop. So, I think this also, it lies behind a lot of the political debates, you know, the debates that go on in Parliament. Yeah. It's so often what you hear is a litany of stories, don't you, of, yeah, terribly painful. You know, I saw my friend and he was in agony and he pleaded for help, yeah, and so on. So I think, you know, this does touch, you know, it's much more than just an interesting philosophical.
Definitely. And it's easy, I think, for those of us who talk about these things regularly to kind of get, you know, akin to a discussion like something like abortion, to get sucked into the ethical dilemmas and the theology of it and the philosophy and forget that these are primarily real people, not interesting trolley problems on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And in particular, the debate has been re-enlivened in the UK, hasn't it, in recent months by a particular person, by Esther Ranson, who's a kind of well-known TV presenter, who herself is terminally ill, I understand, and is kind of off her own back launched a campaign saying that she should have the right to an assisted death, and has kind of won some key concessions from who is now, as we'll discuss later in the episode, from our new prime minister. So again, it is so often these things hinge not on kind of chin stroking ivory tower debate, but about real people responding to other real people's meaningful experiences and stories.
Yes. And I think we've mentioned it before, but I think it's very striking that this is mainly being driven, it seems to me, by the baby boomers generation, you know, which is my generation. I'm right in the middle of the baby boomer group. And people of my generation, there are many, many of us who basically lived our lives believing firmly that we have the right to control it all. We were the first generation who really took on this idea of autonomy and self-control and self-governance and doing it my way. Yeah. You know, that's our anthem. Frank Sinatra is still...
It's the most common song, isn't it, in crematorium. People always, all the service always say, I did it my way.
I know, it's extraordinary. And so for that generation, who have been used to controlling absolutely everything in their life, they find it utterly inconceivable that as they come to their death and their dying and the manner and the timing of their dying, they simply find it outrageous and inconceivable that the law does not give them the right to choose the time and the manner of their death.
Yeah. Yeah. But before we get to what's been happening here in the UK and some of the important developments there, we wanted to start with an interesting news piece that you spotted from the States. A lot of this campaign increasingly has started to, people on both sides of the debate kind of look overseas for parallels in other jurisdictions where there are increasing numbers of states and countries which have legalized different forms of assisted dying. And often campaigners will kind of say, well, it could be like that, or we mustn't do it like that. And one place which has an unusually kind of liberal law is the state of Vermont, isn't it, in the US?
Yes. So apparently there are now 10 states across the USA where I would refer to as assisted suicide, medically assisted suicide, is legal. But until very recently, in all of those 10 states, it was only legal for people who are resident in that own state. But in May 2023, Vermont lifted its residency requirement, and the same has happened apparently in Oregon. And so what has started happening now in the States is suicide tourism.
Hmm. So these are people from other parts of the US who live in states where this is not an option to them, and they decide they would like to kill themselves or be helped to die. And so they jump on a plane in a car and come to find a doctor in Vermont or Oregon or one of these other states and say, I'm not a normally resident here, but I've come to die.
Yes, that's right. But they have to go through whatever the state's regulations are, which involve some kind of assessment within the state. They have to travel to the state. They have to be fully assessed. They have to have the opinion, I think, of two doctors that they meet the criteria, that they've got a terminal illness, that they are mentally competent, and that they've got less than 6 months to live. And once they've met that assessment process, there's then a waiting period. Again, varies in the different states, but it's often a period of weeks where before they're allowed. So then they may go back to their home state and then have to come back for actually the event itself.
Mm. And it's interesting to me that when these states originally passed their laws, you know, some of them are quite old. I think Oregon is over 20 years ago when it introduced its own assisted dying laws. They were originally almost always drawn up with residency requirements to deliberately prevent this kind of euthanasia tourism, to use a ghoulish term. And it's only in the last few years that out-of-staters have been kind of able to take advantage of this. What do you think is driving that kind of change of approach? You know, why was it kind of consensus in Oregon that this should just be for Oregonians, and now it's seen as a kind of a justice issue to open it up for people living as far afield as maybe Texas or Florida?
Yes, I suspect that's the argument, isn't it? Because this is a very similar issue taking place with abortion, isn't it? That now certain states in the USA have either made abortion completely illegal or made it very restrictive, but other states are effectively allowing people to come out of state and have abortions there. And I suppose it is a kind of justice issue. You know, just because I happen to live, you know, 1 mile the wrong side of the border, why should I be penalized just by something so arbitrary as where you happen to live?
Hmm. And I wonder if as well it's been kind of unintentionally turbocharged by the intensity of the discussion around abortion, which, as you know, everyone knows, was previously kind of guaranteed in all 50 states in theory through the Roe versus Wade ruling, which kind of ruled that access to abortion was a constitutional right for women. That ruling was overturned a couple of years ago, and now it's it's been left up to the states. So it's kind of on the same level as it is with assisted dying, where it varies from state to state. And yet there is now, you know, increasing kind of anger and outrage that in, you know, predominantly more conservative kind of red leaning pro-life states, if you are living in a state like Florida or Texas, which has quite a restrictive abortion rules, maybe kind of a 6-week limit rather than a 20-week limit, you now have to be able to afford to travel out of state. And that's kind of raised attention, I suppose, to the issue of kind of what we would call in the UK a postcode lottery, what you know, the state by state lottery of and maybe it's bled over from abortion into this kind of parallel issue of assisted dying.
Yeah, I think that's right. Of course, it's worth pointing out that there's a massive difference in the numbers we're talking about. Yeah. You know, when we're talking about abortion in the USA, the numbers are astronomical, hundreds of thousands, I think 600,000 abortions or more a year. Whereas the numbers for assisted suicide are very comparatively low. They're in the teens or tens of, and so it's a very small number, but certainly in Oregon, and I think probably across the USA, there is a very clear trend year on year for the numbers to increase, because it seems to be an idea whose time has arrived.
Mm-hmm.
That if you have a terminal illness, and that actually to control the time of your death just fits with modern people.
Mm. And in this article kind of exploring the idea of euthanasia tourism, they quote a woman called Peg Sandine, who's the head of American advocacy group Death with Dignity. And she said that many states initially passed quite restrictive laws, for instance, quote, requiring 21-day wait times and psychiatric evaluations, only to eventually repeal provisions that prove unduly onerous. That makes her optimistic that more states will eventually follow Vermont and Oregon. So, you know, to translate what, you know, even the kind of assisted dying advocates are saying, look, initially to get the bills passed, they're often framed quite tightly. They exclude out-of-staters and they have cooling off periods and rigorous evaluations. But over time, these get whittled away. And we're hoping and expecting that in time, some of the other states that have some form of euthanasia law on the books will gradually kind of liberalize them in the way that Oregon and Vermont have.
Yes. And they tell the story of a lady with a recurrence of ovarian cancer in her 60s. And there's just this very stark quote. I really wanted to take control over how I left this world.
Hmm.
I decided that this was an option for me. You know, and it's a very straightforward, I want to take control over how I leave this world. And I think whereas concern about pain and suffering is often presented as the sort of headline reason for this, and it's all about compassion, actually, I think that the autonomy argument is for most people the strongest argument, and certainly it is for the baby boomers.
I mean, they quote a doctor here, an oncologist in Oregon, who runs a whole clinic for people who want to die, and he said it's about a quarter of his patients now are people from out of state. But he says this only about a third of people who get approved, you know, so who are signed off by two doctors as meeting the requirements for an assisted death don't actually follow through. The doctor said, for them, it's often enough to know they have the meds, the control to end their lives when they want. And so it's fascinating to me that for some people, a significant minority, it's in the end, they don't actually want to kill themselves. They just want to know that if they wanted to down the line, they have been given the loaded gun in their hand, effectively, to use a kind of brutal metaphor, that they now have the power and access to give themselves the medical death that they want, and that actually is sufficient, and actually they can go on and live and let themselves die naturally.
Absolutely right, and this is one of the arguments that's often put forward by pro activists, that just giving people the knowledge that they have this available. So what happens in Oregon is that once you've gone through all the process of being assessed, the doctor prescribes a lethal mixture of tablets. You're told how to take it. You're told, and then it's handed over to you. And in Oregon, the argument is actually that the doctor should not be present when really? It happens.
Because they just let people walk around with lethal tablets and take them at their own homes or leave them insecurely lying about.
Don't leave this lying around. But it's a bit like rat poisoning. Not a good thing to, some children came across it, but.
Wow. I didn't realize that. So they, yeah. I thought they would just have the prescription, but they'd obviously have to go and like, but no, they actually physically give them the medication and then say when and where and how you take this is in your hands and nothing to do with us.
Well, it fits with this kind of libertarian, American perspective, doesn't it? Because the argument goes is if I, the doctor, say, well, here's the tablets. Now, I'm going to stand over and watch you and just make sure that you absolutely get those tablets in the right place. And I'm not going to leave here. Until it's a kind of coercive influence that the doctor is bringing, and therefore, in order to protect the autonomy, the doctor should not be there. It's the same in Dignitas. In the Dignitas clinic in Switzerland, my understanding is that it's against the law for the doctor to be there. They have volunteers who are actually present in the clinic. The doctor prescribes the medication, but then absents themselves.
And this obviously limits those who can take advantage of it to people who still have the physical capacity to personally, depress a syringe driver or personally neck back a glass of water and some pills. Because there are another category of people who want doctors to actually do the killing themselves because they're no longer capable and they're presumably excluded from these laws.
That's right. And interestingly, what has been proposed in the UK is that the doctor should be present and should ensure that the tablets are taken and administered. And the doctor then sort of tidies up and removes any medication and takes personal responsibility for ensuring that the deed is done cleanly and all the rest. So it's, I'm sorry, this is very grisly. To talk through, but it's important to be aware of the fact that things are not often as neat and clean as you would think. And one of the terrible possibilities, which has been frequently recorded, is that the person takes the tablets and then doesn't die as they expected, or even could have, and they wake up and may have complications. They can vomit and aspirate and have all kinds of problems. So it doesn't necessarily occur in the very clean way that one might anticipate.
And just before we leave Vermont and Oregon behind, there's just one other thing that jumped out from this story, which is about, you mentioned the kind of key anecdote, the woman whose story runs through it, is this woman who has ovarian cancer, which recurring ovarian cancer, and she travels to Vermont to get kind of approval, but it only lasts for 6 months, and then it kind of lapses, and she actually kind of starts to feel a bit better, and so allows her 6 month kind of period to lapse, and then she has to go back to Vermont to get reapproved for assisted dying. And obviously she's driving quite a long way. It's like a 9-hour drive. So what she does second time round is, she said, she just drove over the borderline, but still 3 hours away from where the doctor is, and then just opened up a Zoom call and was approved and did the kind of consultation required over Zoom. And she's like, I don't actually know if they could have checked if I could have done the Zoom call from my bedroom in a different state, but I thought it's best to be cross state lines. But clearly what it throws up is, and we discussed this before in the context of abortion and kind of telemedicine pills by post, is that in the 21st century, a lot of this stuff can be done remotely. And so it may well be that physical residency requirements, once you are they enforceable in an era when all these consultations are taking place on Zoom? How does the doctor prove where you are Zooming in from, and if you are or are not a resident, and these kind of things? And you could even, in theory, believe it might be possible to do transnational cases, where someone from another country, not another state, zooms in and is then sent in the international mail the medication required. So there's a lot of unforeseen, or I guess problems that maybe when Oregon passed its law in 1997 or whatever it was, never really thought how it would interact with an internet kind of Zoom consultation age.
Yes, and also that reminds me about, you know, there have been some very, very troubling dark stories of, this is not sort of medically approved suicides, but of chat rooms and places where on the internet where depressed people can go and can get advice about how to kill themselves, and you know, medicines are sent across borders. And so there's a very dark aspect, sadly, to this, that of people who feel suicidal, who feel their lives are pointless, and of other people who are prepared to help them. For me, you know, I'm just thinking, what has this got to do with medicine? This is, you know, the basic medical calling to me is about protecting and valuing and preserving life, and that once killing is part of the medical activity, it does fundamentally change the nature of what it means to be a physician.
And it immediately reminds me of reading some of the history about how abortion came to be legalized in the UK in the 1960s. And a large part of the argument was effectively, look, backstreet abortions are already happening. We can't stop them. Why not bring them within the safe, clean, sterilized, regulated medical world of the NHS? Isn't that much better than women having to go to these dodgy, dubious backstreet doctors and having the complications and the botched procedures and dying on the table and this kind of thing? And I wonder if something similar might eventually happen around suicide, where if these, you know, because the authorities have found it very, very difficult to shut down access to these kind of pro-suicide websites where they will give you very precise instructions about how to combine various materials to make lethal concoctions so you can take yourself. If this becomes commonplace, you know, perhaps you can make the argument, look, people are going to kill themselves, but they're going to botch it and do it wrong, and it's going to be funded by organized crime. Why don't we create an effectively a medically assisted suicide service within the NHS so it's regulated, safe, clean, you know, all that kind of thing?
Yes. So philosophically, you know, what is underlying this is a shift. So historically, we as a society have always said that suicide was something we don't promote, we don't accept, we always resist it. So that when someone is on a bridge threatening to kill themselves, we don't say, well, hang on a minute, let's just assess them whether this is really inappropriate for you. We just take a default position that this is not
It's never the right response never to whatever, the right you're, response, suffering,
whatever you're suffering. And what's more, we're prepared to risk the lives of emergency workers to clamber up onto the bridge in order to stop you killing yourself. And that's the way as a society we've lived. But what is being proposed and what has already happened in other societies is that we now say, no, let's divide suicides or suicidal attempts into two categories. One, rational, state approved, and two,
good
irrational.
Suicides, bad suicides.
Exactly. And so the most important thing is to work out, is this a rational suicide or is this not? And how do we do that? Well, in places like the Netherlands, the criteria is hopeless and unbearable suffering. If you can demonstrate to me you have hopeless and unbearable suffering, then I, as a doctor, I'm prepared to help you to kill yourself. Here in the UK, what is being proposed is a rational suicide is only 6 months to live, mentally competent, meet the following criteria. Mm. Everything else is irrational and cannot be supported.
And we should just, so we should explain that. So we last discussed this back in May when we were talking about the bill that had been introduced to the Scottish Parliament, the private members' bill. But since then, there has been an election in the UK government. There's been a change of government. But also there's a new parliamentary term in Westminster. And so a couple of things have happened. So primarily the new Labour government led by Keir Starmer, under pressure from Esther Ranson, the TV presenter we mentioned earlier, has kind of pledged that he would create space in the parliamentary timetable for the House of Commons, the lower house of parliament, to discuss a bill on assisted suicide. And he would give MPs, his MPs, a free vote. There would be no Labour, official Labour policy they had to follow. They're allowed to follow their consciences. So that's coming at some undetermined point. But in the meantime, a regular campaigner in the House of Lords, the upper house of parliament, Lord Falconer, who has regularly introduced bills, he has, through divine providence or lack thereof, come second in a ballot. They take a private, basically, at the beginning of each session of parliament, you can suggest, I would like to introduce this bill. And then they take a ballot and they just draw names out of a hat. And he came second. So his bill is also going to be debated at some point imminently in the House of Lords. And it's his bill you're referring to that, as usual, is kind of closely modelled on the Oregonian model. And so you'd only qualify if you were an adult who was deemed to be competent to make medical decisions about their life and who is being assessed by two doctors as having less than 6 months to live.
That's right. And I think, again, we're going to get a major debate on this, as we have had previously. Previously, both votes in the House of Lords and House of Commons have come quite significantly against, although the last vote in the House of Lords was very close, as I remember. There are now a whole bunch, new bunch of MPs, many of them Labour MPs. Yep. There are more new Lords in the House of Lords. And I suspect there is, to be honest, a very high chance that we will have legislation here in England and Wales in favour of some form of assisted dying within this parliament.
Hmm. So for those not familiar with kind of parliamentary procedure, while the House of Lords, the upper chamber, they can introduce their own private members' bills, it's very, very rare for those bills to actually ultimately become law. So really, Falconer et al., and there are other lords who've been doing this practically, they more introduce these bills as a kind of campaigning mechanism. The real action takes place but with the elected MPs in the House of Commons. And the last time a bill was brought to the House of Commons was in 2015, when it was quite it was debated in the House of Commons and very, again, on a free vote, no party whip, but it was heavily defeated, 330-18. But it's been, you know, 9 years, almost 10 years since then, there's been massive changes in the composition of the House of Commons, as you said. And so anyone's guess is if and when it does come back to the House of Commons and a private member's bill is introduced there, which we don't know, but it's possible it will follow the kind of Falconer model, the 6 month terminally ill model. It's anyone's guess as to how it will happen, because it relies on 650 individual MPs consulting their consciences and deciding how to vote.
Yes, I'm not sure those numbers were quite right, but there was a resound. We'll put it in the show notes. There was a resounding defeat.
Oh, sorry, yeah. 330-118.
Did you know that this month marks the 4th anniversary of Premier Insight, the ministry that brings you this podcast? While it's a real season of celebration, there's also a very real financial challenge that must be met this month. Due to rising costs and the pressure of inflation, there's a $35,000 gap that must be closed this month to keep Premier Insight moving forward with strength. So that's why I'm asking you to give a special anniversary gift to keep programs like this podcast on the air and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
Susan. Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So I think there is, sadly, a from our perspective, I think quite a strong chance that some form of euthanasia legislation will be passed. And at the moment, it does look like an Oregon-type bill. But I think both of us can also guess what would happen as soon as a bill like that was passed.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's almost inevitable, isn't it? Because you can immediately think, well, what about the edge cases? You know, what about someone who is deemed to have 7 months to live? Why are they not able to avail themselves of a medically assisted death on the NHS? How is that fair? How is that just? You know, a lot of the arguments that are used, the geographical arguments that are used in the States, you know, I live the wrong side of a state line, but why is it fair that I'm denied my suicide, my medically assisted suicide? A lot of those arguments will apply not geographically, but will apply in kind of time sense. You know, I've got 12 months to live. Why do I not qualify? So there will immediately be very strong pressure to expand the eligibility criteria.
And similarly, with people who have difficulty in taking the drugs, you know, it's not fair that I can't, I'm not physically capable of killing myself. Why can't a doctor take the responsibility to kill me? And of course, there have been, those cases have been aired in the past, and you know, likely to happen again, aren't they?
Yeah, several prominent kind of court cases where people often maybe kind of quadriplegic or have some other kind of serious condition which prevents them from being able to, you know, take pills themselves, have applied to the High Court, arguing that the law that would kind of criminalize their wife or their GP for helping them die is unjust and unfair and that kind of thing. And they've so far, they've kind of failed. Although the government, the prosecuting authorities basically look the other way if you help someone travel to Switzerland to do it at Dignitas, and no one really gets prosecuted for that anymore within certain boundaries. But certainly those cases, those famous cases, which often the impetus, none of them would qualify under the Faulkner bill, would they? Because they would require a doctor or a third party to actually physically, you know, put the pills in their mouth or inject them with some kind of lethal concoction.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think, you know, it's a wearying certainty that those are going to be all will come back again. And then another tragic cases are people with a progressive neurological or degenerative condition, such as Alzheimer's, sometimes Parkinson's, other conditions, which means that as they deteriorate, they lose the competence. And so what has happened in other countries is that the idea of an advanced directive, I can say, you know, if I ever come to the point when I lose competence because of a terminal illness, and I know I've got a diagnosis, I know it's going to happen, if it ever comes to that point, I wish to be killed. And the argument will go, well, how on earth can we hold back? You know, if they were competent, yes, they would have done the deed themselves. But now, tragically, just before they got to be able to do this, they lost their competence.
And then, of course, the desperately sad situation then arises if advanced decisions are legal, is that you end up with people who might have advanced dementia, but are actually appear to be very content, well cared for, totally placid, actually living a reasonable quality of life, even if they have lost some mental competence, we're going to then be strapping them down and injecting them with a lethal substance. Just because their previous self, 6 months earlier, as they envisaged this stage of decline, thought it would be hell on earth, and so signed off an advanced decision, and then it just becomes incredibly painful and ethically, pastorally, medically complicated to know how to, is it right to follow what this person wanted to do 6 months ago, but they didn't really have any insight into what it actually would be like to be this far declined. You know, and so what happened in Canada, for example, is that there were a number of famous cases of people who said, you know, I can see my decline coming, and I can tell that in 6, 12, 18 months, I will cross over the boundary and I will no longer be able to be mentally competent to decide to die. I don't want to die right now because I've got more life to live, but I will choose to kill myself now while I can be approved by the system. And this is spun as a huge injustice because it's robbing another year of life before the person would be ready to die, but they have to kill themselves too soon to make sure that they can kill themselves at all. So that's how it will be presented. Mm. They'll say, look, the 6 month window is too tight because by the time I'm 6 months to die, I won't be deemed mentally competent. And so I'm stuck in this catch 22.
Mm. Yeah. And so I think the other thing which is almost a racing certainty is that this will be seen as, once a bill is passed, it becomes an NHS responsibility to make sure that all patients across the UK have access to this if they wish it. And therefore it's something that has to be introduced into mainstream NHS care. When doctors are assessing people at the end of life and they're looking at the treatment options, now an additional treatment option has to be considered, and that doctors are then find themselves, even if they personally are not being forced to prescribe lethal drugs, they are being told they must inform everybody of this possibility, and make arrangements for them to be referred to other doctors who will be prepared to give them the treatment if they meet the criteria.
And people might remember we had an episode several years ago where we interviewed a Canadian doctor who was in this exact scenario where she, as a Christian, did not feel it was right for her, morally right for her, to be involved at all with assisting the suicide of her patients. And while her local kind of health authorities said that she had a right to personally not have to be involved in that, she was obliged to refer people on to doctors, I believe, as far as I recall, who would. You know, she couldn't step out entirely, but if a patient said, you know, I'm thinking maybe I should kill myself, she could say, I won't do it, but here is a doctor who will, you know, have that conversation with you, which she found, again, very, very difficult and challenging as a Christian and as a physician to know what is the action, what is the path of integrity in that circumstance. And I guess there's again another parallel here with abortion, where in the UK law, doctors have the right to kind of conscientiously object from taking part in abortions, but that doesn't mean that you can, you know, there are no abortion-free zones, there are no abortion-exempt obstetrics units in the country. So if you are an obstetrician, in some sense, it will bleed into your kind of practice in some sense.
Yes, but the big difference, which I think many people haven't really come to terms with, is that whereas abortion in the UK and in the NHS is a very, very localised issue, it really only impacts on obstetricians, or fetal medicine specialists, or to a lesser extent on GPs. Once some form of assisted suicide for terminal illness becomes available, this is going to impact virtually every adult medical department in the hospital, because every specialty has terminally ill patients, and therefore patients who meet these criteria, and therefore every specialty will have to develop procedures, have training on how to handle this, and because so much hospital work and GP work is all about teams, we're part of large interdisciplinary teams, even if I personally have a conscience about this, the problem is if other members of my team who are caring for the same patients are perfectly happy to be involved in the process, that means that the patients that I care for may well receive assisted suicide, however much I personally think this is abhorrent. And that, so it does lay the question, doesn't it? Can I, in good conscience, work within the NHS if my patients are being constantly affected? You know, this elderly lady who is frightened and concerned, you know, one of my colleagues is now explaining to her that it's an option for her to kill herself.
Yeah. And you've talked before about your hope that kind of Christians in the medical establishment would be getting ahead of the curve and saying, yes, of course, we will advocate and lobby and campaign and fight against legalization of assisted suicide. But if it does come, we need to have a plan. And you said before, your hope, your dream would be that there would be, you know, euthanasia-free zones. There would be hospitals or wings or wards or clinics or specialisms where euthanasia is not legally permissible and where patients and doctors can gravitate towards if they feel strongly that that is not something they want to be a part of. But very little sign of that ever, something like that ever being pulled off in any of the other countries overseas, is there, where euthanasia has come in?
No, sadly, what we've tended to see in a number of countries overseas, Canada, again, particularly comes to mind, is that the state has forced independent facilities,
often with a Christian foundation,
to comply with providing this service, and that you know, independent palliative care centres and all the rest have become under enormous pressure. And on a theoretical grounds, you would say, you know, surely, you know, given the fact that at present something like 40% of physicians and probably a bigger percentage of healthcare professionals overall are deeply opposed to this practice and don't want to have anything to do with it, and feel it morally repugnant to be forced by the state to comply in this way, surely their rights, okay, they're not the majority, but surely in a modern democratic society, the deeply felt conscience and rights of a minority, a large minority of the population, should be protected by the state.
It touches on this idea that sometimes called philosophers as moral injury, which is the idea that being kind of compelled to do something which contradicts your own internal sense of morals is a form of kind of philosophical, theological injury. And while it doesn't leave any obvious physical scars, it is profoundly psychologically, spiritually damaging to people, doctors in this instance, to be part of a system which compels them to take part in the deaths of their vulnerable patients against their instincts or their moral intuitions, against their conscience.
That's right. And in fact, I would want to use even stronger language and say it's not only an injury, it's a violation. It's a form of rape. It's a rape of the heart that my most deeply held conscience and principles are being violated by state power. And, you know, we're not talking about something relatively superficial here. I mean, to turn me into colluding me as someone who is intentionally killing my patients or participating in the killing of my patients, that's a very profound violation of everything that I as a doctor feel I'm called to. So I suppose what I'm asking for is a recognition of that from the state, you know, that the state would not compel religious believers to do something that was utterly abhorrent to them by state power in other areas. Why should in this area of medical killing there not be respect for minority rights?
And this is a clash that has occurred in other places where because so many there is such a long tradition, isn't there, of Christianity in medicine. You know, so many hospitals and hospices in particular are named after saints and might even have still be, you know, run by kind of Christian institutions. It's come up a lot.
Well, historically, the whole Western medical tradition starts, you know, well, is a synthesis between pagan Hippocratic principles and Judeo-Christian principles from the early church. That's where the hospital, whole Western medical system comes from. So then for it to end up doing something which is utterly abhorrent to that tradition is deeply troubling. But, you know, there is the counter argument, which I've already heard, is, well, you know, if you have this problem, then there's a very simple solution, you know, just don't be a doctor. You go off and be, there are lots of things which Christians can do. It's simply it's not possible for them with their conscience and religious beliefs to enter this particular profession.
And, you know, no one weeps for the Quakers who were prevented from working in the military because of their pacifist convictions. We just say, well, I'm afraid this profession is ruled out to you, but we're not going to make special privileges for Quakers to sign up as soldiers, but they are allowed not to carry guns and not to fight in war. If, you know, we just say, I'm afraid you can't do this job anymore. Is that the reality for Christians? Would you be telling young medical students, look, if you have strong convictions about assisted dying, you might be in the wrong job?
Well, and clearly that can't be right when we're dealing with, you know, the majority of people in this country are not atheists. They're not strong materialists. So to be saying that, you know, medicine, it's not just medicine, it would be all healthcare professionals, are basically, you know, not open to people with strong religious beliefs. I mean, that's a nonsense, isn't it? Fascinatingly, I suspect it may be the non-Christian religions, such as the Muslim doctors, who may carry more political weight.
You know? Yeah, that's plausible.
We're not that worried about going against the interests of Christians, but if we were seen as a state to be causing problems for Muslim doctors, that could be politically embarrassing to us.
Yeah, that's interesting. But in all seriousness, if you're, you know, if a young Christian person is considering their options, their career options, and they come and talk to you and about prospects of a career in medicine, which, you know, if you start training today, your career in medicine is going to finish in the 2070s or something, you know, would you sit them down and say, you know, you need to search your conscience about assisted dying because this is going to be a major part of the reality of what the NHS is like in 2030, 2040, 2050?
No, I wouldn't. I would, in fact, give them a very positive take that you're exactly the kind of people we need in healthcare, people with a conscience, people with a moral compass, people with a sense of service and so on. And what's more, I can virtually guarantee that by the time you are practicing, there are going to be independent medical facilities for Christians. They will be reinvented. I mean, it may take time, but there is no alternative but to create independent facilities for Christians. I mean, they may be small. There may be a small independent sector with a massive NHS. But the other thing I can guarantee is that if those independent Christian facilities, health facilities, do get created, the great British public will beat a path to the door. They will want to be cared for by doctors and nurses who have a commitment to serve because of a faith commitment.
Well, that's a very positive take. As ever, I feel slightly more cynical about the prospects. I mean, you know, you look at, you know, over the centuries, the British state has progressively taken over Christian institutions. You know, Henry did it with the dissolution of the monasteries, confiscated all their wealth and power. And, you know, I don't weep many tears about a lot of that. It was quite corrupt. But, you know, then the education system, which again was almost exclusively set up by the churches, was effectively nationalized and to a large part taken over by the taxpayer and the state. And then the NHS absorbed basically every independent Christian healthcare institution. in the middle of the 20th century, that process seems to often only go one way, and it would be an absolutely enormous undertaking for, you know, a group of nuns or a few churches somewhere to build a hospital. Like, you know, it's not the same thing as it was when you know, St. Thomas's was set up in the 1100s. It's quite a different enterprise. Well, and also, fundamentally, what it would never have be able to compete with is it would be expensive, whereas the NHS is free.
Well, of course, it isn't free. It's just we pay for it massively.
But you're paid for it whether you use it or not.
So there are several things there. Number one, education is actually a very good analogy because the state allows there to be independent schools and does not tell them what they must and mustn't teach. Within there are, you know, some limits to that, but and even allows homeschooling. It does not say you are not allowed by law to do such a dangerous thing as care for another child without the state wading in and telling you exactly what you must and mustn't do. And we in Britain would think that was outrageous if the state told parents how to educate their children.
Actually, several European countries very, very strictly prohibit homeschooling on those exact grounds.
Yeah, but nonetheless,
the UK has a strong tradition of saying parents have a right to teach their own children if they wish.
And so if I, as a state, said, and I'm going to say exactly about the same way you get any medical care, independent medical care is completely forbidden. It's, you know, you must do it our way. You must go through the NHS. There is no alternative. We would all think that is absolutely outrageous. And that's why I think in Britain, by God's grace, as people see the writing on the wall and more people are impacted by this, we will start to say this is unacceptable. We must create separate facilities. And now how they're funded, of course, the argument goes, the state is taking vast amounts of money from me to fund the NHS. Why should that go against my conscience? Why should all the money that the state is being taken to me fund medical activities that I'm deeply unhappy with? Why shouldn't the state in its generosity say that some of the money will be given to allow facilities, state facilities? Well, and that the argument is that with Christian schools, isn't it? That the state has actually supported Church of England schools, it's supported Jewish schools. So there are precedents. So I think either completely independent facilities, or else some version of state support could come into existence. And so I'm not completely pessimistic about it.
And I guess just lastly, then, I know lots of Christian doctors listen to this podcast. We shouldn't underestimate what a big ask for a lot of them that is, you know, because imagine we're 10 years down the line, assisted dying has been legalized, and there is this kind of nascent network of startup healthcare facilities run independently and privately by Christians with a kind of anti-euthanasia ethos, which I would celebrate. But if you are a Christian kind of mid-career doctor, it is a big, big step, a big ask for you to step out of the confines of the NHS, which has trained and funded and paid you and has a well-established, you know, pathway and progression through the ranks into this brand new, very uncertain world. You know, you could be castigated as a kind of bigot and you know, you're only going to be treating the rich and the wealthy rather than you might go into medicine to look after all people. You know, it's a massive, massive shift in the kind of the mindset of how a Christian who went into medicine thought they would be spending their life doing.
No, I get that. I mean, we will not only be treating the rich and the famous. No, that absolutely that won't happen. It never has done. Christian facilities have always tried to make themselves available to the most needy. Yeah. And that means there has to be some kind of cross subsidization. You know, we charge the rich and the wealthy, yes, but that allows us to then provide care for people who can't afford it. But I think you make a very good point. And I think the point is that I managed to work within the NHS as a Christian, being quite open about my faith. Mm. And and astonishingly remained employed as a consultant and as a professor and was allowed to get away with it.
There are only a few dicey moments along the way.
Whereas I suspect that future generations of Christians in the healthcare are going to face exactly that dilemma. You know, am I prepared to put my money where my mouth is? Am I really prepared to take the implications of my Christian faith, even if that really damages my career prospects, even if that, you know, drives me out of mainstream practices? And I think that is always the question, isn't it? Are we prepared as Christians to take the consequences of where our faith leads us, or are we actually going to just keep our mouths quiet and carry on as before?
And this is a dilemma that I think is going to be faced by more and more professions. You know, teachers is having to ask some of the same questions. You know, for centuries, it's been very straightforward to be a Christian and a teacher because the values of the education system lined up very easily with the values of the gospel. And some teachers would say that is coming under increasing strain as our society continues to kind of secularize and drift away from Christian origins. There are points where your perspectives and your values may come into conflict. So I think it's not just doctors and healthcare workers who are going to be facing some of these questions, but also other professions too. So it will be an interesting and challenging kind of few decades ahead of us as we kind of work some of these flashpoints out, where before I think people would have gone into these professions without a moment's thought about whether it would end up kind of challenging their faith.
Yeah, we probably ought to bring things to a close, aren't we? But I totally agree with you. Just if I might be given a bit of a plug, there's a new book called The Reality of Assisted Dying, Understanding the Issues, which is going to be published by the Open University Press on September the 3rd. And I have a chapter in that. It's a big tome looking at all the issues, medical, philosophical, legal, global. And I've got a chapter about euthanasia in the newborn and in children.
Yeah, we'll put a link so people are interested in finding out more about that. It certainly, I think, underlines that this is a question which has kind of come back to the fore and is not going away anywhere. So I'm sure we will be back on this topic on the podcast before too long. But thanks, everyone, for listening. If you're interested in more about assisted dying and euthanasia, there is a large amount of material on johnwyatt.com. You can read, and Dad has got a couple of books as well with links about the topic. So do go and find out more. And we'd really love to know your thoughts as well, particularly if you're a Christian working in medicine, in healthcare, in some capacity. I'd love to know what you thought about our discussion and some of the challenges that might be thrown up by the legal changing of the law. So do get in touch. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. But we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.